Welcome to the New Books and Political Science Podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of Otherworldly Politics, The International Relations of Star Trek, Game of Thrones, and Battlestar Galactica. The book was published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2015. I hope that you really enjoy the interview that I did with the author, Stephen Dyson. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to have Stephen Dyson on the line today to talk about his new book, Otherworldly Politics, The International Relations of Star Trek, Game of Thrones, and Battlestar Galactica. Stephen's book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press this year being 2015. This may be running in 2016, but this is a very recent book. Stephen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. It's great to be speaking to you.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to talk to you as well. It's a pleasure to have read the book. It's a nice after the semester is over book where you get to read some fun stuff. We're in the heat of Star Wars mania, and many of the topics that you're looking at would be just as applicable there. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the book, let's just talk a little bit about yourself. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about who you are?
Well, I'm an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, and I also direct Humanities House at the University of Connecticut, which is a living and learning community that primarily serves freshmen and sophomore students. I've been at UConn since 2007. But I'm not originally from the U.S. I'm from Britain. I came over to the U.S. in 2000 for grad school. I've lived in Washington State. That's where I went to grad school. I've taught in Minnesota and Indiana and now in Connecticut.
So this is the otherworldly of your otherworldly politics title, is you were from another world. Now, it's not really what your book is about. Your book is about these different fictional universes that that we populate in sometimes, and all of their relationships to the field of international relations. Let's talk, how much fun was it to write this book? Before we even talk about what you wrote, this had to have been just a really interesting book to write. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about its background.
Yeah, it was great fun to write. The background was, I think it's a sort of once in a career story of serendipity, and something happened to me that I think everyone dreams will happen to them. I'd always been interested in science fiction and fantasy, and I'd started to write short web essays, most particularly for a blog called The Monkey Cage, which was an independent blog at the time that I started sending them things and is now part of the Washington Post. And I wrote a short essay about what was then the new Star Trek movie. It was Star Trek Into Darkness. And then I wrote something about Battlestar Galactica, and these are the two of the shows that I talk about in the book. And these were just intended to be sort of 800-word essays, where I'd say, hey, you know, here's this movie, here's some of the political ideas behind it, here's this TV series, I think it's really, really interesting, we should be watching it. And you know, these things go online, and you hope that people read them, and you never know who will read them. And it turns out with these essays, one of the people who read them was the political science editor at Johns Hopkins University, Johns Hopkins University Press. And so I got into work the next morning, and I opened up my email, and I had a message from Susan Flinchberg, who was the editor at that point. And she said, I read your Monkey Cage post. Is there any more of this work? Would you like to write a book for us? And I said, you know what? I would. I think that would be terrific. The slight problem was that, you know, she was asking, is there any more of this work? And there was, in fact, no more of that work. There were exactly 1,600 words mm-hmm. in existence. So she then gave me a pretty short time period during which to write the book, but that was good, I think. It made it a focused experience, and I got to work.
Yeah, you know, it's the side of writing for non-traditional sources, and Monkey Cage would be one, there are now numerous, that I think we don't pay as much attention. It's typically seen as the place where we take our research and show it off to some new audiences, but that return feedback that could result in future research publications is something that I think you're probably not alone in experiencing. I think it's really an interesting side of this. Let's talk about the book. And the book is about international relations, and I think even those of us who don't study this deeply know about this classic divide between the realists and the liberals. You look to the fictional world of Game of Thrones to help explain this. So, who are the realists and who are the liberals in the world of Westeros?
So I think the whole first season of Game of Thrones is really an excellent illustration of this old liberal and realist divide, the liberals or the idealists, of course, being people who very much believe that politics should be about values and should be about ethics, and that human beings and human nature is fundamentally good, and the way that you promote peace in the world, and peace is achievable, is that you act in accordance with your values and you trust other people. And I think they were represented, especially in the first season and actually in later seasons, by the Starks in Game of Thrones, these guardians of the North, these people like Ned Stark, who was an extremely stubborn individual, an extremely moralistic individual, someone who always wanted to do the right thing, someone who was, as many liberals are, many idealists are, pretty bad at the down and dirty work of politics. And in Game of Thrones, Ned is doing well up in the North. You know, he's amongst his own people and he understands its politics and he's able to make a virtue of his idealism. And then the king comes to see him and the king is his old friend and the king says, I need you in the South. Well, Southern politics is very different. Southern politics is the realm of realpolitik and it's the realm of the Stark's great antagonists, the Lannisters, who I think, you know, really represent the sort of realist point of view. And so Ned very unwisely follows his friend down south. It's the right thing to do. He gave his word to the friend. He owes duty to his friend, the king. And he meets a sticky end in the South because he's outmaneuvered by realists.
And we can say, for those of you that haven't watched the show...
Yeah, spoiler alert, by the way.
Right. And you haven't yet been spoiled. This is not nearly the spoiler that one might think. And you write in the book about Star Trek, Game of Thrones, Battlestar Galactic, and a couple of others. You don't write about Star Wars, so there will be no Star Wars spoilers in this either. One of the central assumptions made by scholars in lots of fields is the extent to which rationality is just an abstract idea or something that really drives decision making. And Trekkies have their own way to express this debate. So what is Dr. Spock's rationality and how is that show using that idea to help explain this concept to a wider audience?
Well, Mr. Spock's probably the greatest fictional representation of what is in danger in academic circles of being a pretty boring, bloodless theory, right? The theory of rational choice. And you try and explain this to students and their eyes glaze over. But if you can dramatize it in the figure of someone like Mr. Spock, then you can keep them interested. And Spock on Star Trek was a Vulcan, someone who was absolutely committed to making decisions on from a logical standpoint, from calculating the costs and the benefits. And I think the greatest representation of this, or the greatest instantiation of this, was in the great movie The Wrath of Khan, which is my favorite movie. And again, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen The Wrath of Khan, Spock applies his utilitarianism, his rationality throughout the movie, really to help his friend James Kirk. And Kirk is the great embodiment of emotion and the great embodiment of feeling. And Spock is cool and Kirk is hot. And of course, when the two work together, that's when they can really be successful. And they are successful. They defeat Kirk's great nemesis, Khan. And it's Spock's rationality and Kirk's emotion works together to defeat Khan. But there's a huge cost. And Spock is faced with a decision which involves him, sacrificing himself so that the ship can be saved and his friends can escape from Khan. And he makes that decision, or at least he expresses that decision in cold, logical terms. And he says, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. And that's a perfect illustration of utilitarianism and of rational choice, and of the fact that if you follow, if you make decisions purely on a rational calculus, sometimes that can lead you to paradoxical or uncomfortable places. And this was the great story. This has been the great story of rational choice in political science, that it can uncover surprising outcomes, surprising decisions, or uncomfortable decisions. And Spock really does dramatize that perfectly, I think.
Now, given some of the recent Republican debates, some of the Cold War concerns that you write about in the book, particularly about nuclear war, it feels so much more real now than even just, I don't know, for myself a couple of weeks ago. And science fiction really grew up in that environment in the 1950s and 60s. And so I was really intrigued by your writing about Dr. Strangelove. Which theories from international relations are played out in that movie? And maybe you could talk just a little bit about how connected Stanley Kubrick was to actually some of the academic literature on the subject and how he incorporated into this fictional movie that he made.
Yeah, what was going on after the sort of couple of decades after the Second World War is American political science was developing as a discipline, and it did so distinctively in the United States as opposed to Europe. In Europe, it retained far more links to sort of the humanities and philosophy and sociology and so forth. In the United States, political science became like rational actor theory, you know, what we were just talking about, and it became imbued with or closest to economics. So that was one thing that was going on in political science at that point. Another thing that was going on was that political scientists were starting to work quite closely with the government. And so you had these think tanks that would bridge government and would an academia, places like the Rand Corporation. And so these influences came together with what was going on in world politics, the development of a Cold War, the development of nuclear weapons. And there was a merging in between a school of political analysis that was very rational and very sort of based on economics logic, and the government needing to develop a set of policies to deal with the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and that would also deal with the fact that you had the Soviet Union and the United States with increasingly large and sophisticated nuclear arsenals. Some of the theories that were most applicable here were things like deterrence theory, rational deterrence theory, and what became known as the logic of mutually assured destruction, which is a totally rational, logical concept, right? Which is the peace will be kept by the fact that I will be so scared of launching my nuclear weapons against you, because I know if I do, you will launch your nuclear weapons against me. And so that mutual fear, that fear of mutually assured destruction, will paradoxically enough keep the peace between us. And that was coming out of political science and all the influences that I described. But it was really, if you think about it, a sort of totally ludicrous scenario that you had these sort of great theories of death and these weapons of mass destruction that were supposed to keep the peace. And to people like Stanley Kubrick, who would read these academic theories and the calculations that would go into deterrence and mutually assured destruction, it seemed absurd. And that's where Dr. Strangelove came from. Kubrick had originally intended to write a thriller. Dr. Strangelove was supposed to be a straight-up thriller about a chain of events that would go wrong, leading to a launch of nuclear weapons that, of course, would signal the end of life on Earth. But he read the academic theories on this stuff, and he looked into what the government policy was, and he thought, this is absurd. There is no way to shoot this straight up. You know, we've entered into the realm of utter absurdity that is also absolutely terrifying. And that was the provenance of Dr. Strangelove. It's a movie I show in class a lot, because not only is it, you know, deeply funny and deeply satirical, it's also a great document of the historical times, but it also really gets you to think about these notions of deterrence and these notions of rationality in a very visceral way.
Now, the one movie TV program that I hadn't seen myself that was really new to me was Battlestar Galactica, and I think I remember the old version of it, but there's this newer version.
Very different to the new version.
Yeah, right. And so the idea that this was have any significance was so surprising to me, though I have heard a lot of people really enjoy the show. And you talk about that. You talk about a particular episode in the series. I wonder if you could talk about this somewhat newer take and how it's coming at some of these ideas.
Well, I think Battlestar Galactica, which ran in its what was called the reimagined version, from 2003 to 2009, is the central, you know, pop culture political crossover text of our time. And Battlestar Galactica was brought to the screen by a guy who'd been involved in another one of the shows that I talked about, Ronald D. Moore, who'd been a writer on Star Trek: The Next Generation and on Star Trek: Deep Space Nine. And Ronald D. Moore had decided that Star Trek was not serious enough and it was not dark enough, and particularly in this post 9/11 world. Also this world with advancing robot technology, also this world with advancing cloning technology, that Star Trek was no longer really speaking to modern concerns. It was too idealistic. The storytelling was too episodic. And he looked at Battlestar Galactica, which, as you say, existed in the 1970s and was kind of this cheesy, stupid, cartoonish type thing. And he said, yes, that was a stupid show in the 70s, but its central premise, you have a few survivors fleeing essentially an apocalypse, you know, and fleeing for their lives. That central premise is really, really interesting and really dark, and it will resonate in a post-9/11 world in a way that it didn't before. And I think the specific episode that you're talking about that I write about extensively in the book is the first episode of season one. It's called 33. And it's an episode that dramatizes crises, political crises, foreign policy crises in just a superb way, a really visceral way. And the premise of 33 is that the humans, having just seen their civilization wiped out, are running for their lives, and they're escaping from their antagonists, the enemy, the Cylons, and the Cylons keep reappearing every 33 minutes, and then the humans are able to get away, but they only get, you know, this 32-minute respite from this grinding existential crisis, and the crew can't sleep, they're losing their minds, people are dying because of human mistakes, the Cylons aren't even having to do anything, because after 3 or 4 days of this, everyone is so sleep deprived that they can't even make the ship function. They keep blowing themselves up. And so I think 33 is really an excellent testament and an excellent document of crises and the challenges that face top level decision makers during crises. You know, you have a president in Battlestar Galactica, a military commander in Battlestar Galactica, and they're having to make life and death calls in an instant. And when they haven't slept, and when they can't really know all the information, and what I do with that episode 33 is juxtapose it with the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took not 33 minutes but 13 days. But a lot of the testimony from people who made decisions during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, talked a lot about the experience of the Cuban Missile Crisis. A lot of the same themes show through. You know, people are sleep deprived. They're looking at the end of the world. They're trying to make life and death decisions. There's no one else to make the decisions but them. And then you get something that we forget about sometimes in political science, which is at the end of the day, policies and states and war and peace, it all comes down to human beings making decisions. And if the human beings get it wrong, then it's a big problem.
Now, I thought the book was just so interesting, and having watched or read about many of these different movies and TV, it was such an interesting treatment of them. Is there something that you watch now that maybe you could recommend for how closely it aligns with some of the events of our days? And, you know, maybe this is a future book project for you, but something that you could recommend for us to start the new year with.
I think my strongest recommendation would be a show that's it just finished its second season on HBO, and it's called The Leftovers. And it's not explicitly a political show, but I think it does tell us a lot about it does, if you read into it a little bit more deeply, it does tell us a lot about politics, a lot about societies, a lot about some of the concerns that drive our everyday life. And what happens in The Leftovers is 2% of the population disappears. And you'd think, well, this is an odd show. This is an odd post-apocalypse show, because in a post-apocalypse show, it's usually 98% of the population is dead or wiped out, and there's only 2% left. But what happens if you reverse that? Well, a central problem that society faces in The Leftovers is 2% of people disappear. There is then no tenable grand narrative for politics, for society, for life, for science that exists anymore. None of the religions can explain what's happened. There's absolutely no scientific explanation. And so how do micro-narratives, people's everyday lives, go on? And how do people change when the grand narratives are shattered? I mean, what would... Science can't progress because there's no scientific explanation for this event that indisputably happened. And so it's a sneakily horrifying show. Because you start to explore what really would happen if this inexplicable event took place. And the second season, I thought the first season was brilliant, but everyone said it was too dark and too boring. I guess I have specific tastes. Mm-hmm. But the second season was sort of, I also thought was fantastic and was widely acclaimed across the board. So that's my recommendation, The Leftovers on HBO.
Yeah, it's a great recommendation. Also, a great recommendation is Stephen's current book, Otherworldly Politics, The International Relations of Star Trek, Game of Thrones, and Battlestar Galactica, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2015. Stephen, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you very much.